When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Missing and Unexplained podcast. I want to thank all of you who have subscribed to the Patreon page, and if you haven't, head over there and check it out. You'll get early access to content as well as exclusive content, all for $3 a month. Also, I have a sleek new website. You can check it out at themissingpod.com. Today, I have Jonathan Walczak on the show, who is an investigative journalist and host of the Missing in Alaska podcast. Missing in Alaska is about two congressmen who vanished from a small plane over Alaska in 1972. I don't want to say much more than that because the story that unravels is wild. I highly encourage you to go check out Missing in Alaska. I also can't promise there won't be any spoilers in this episode. Here's my conversation with John Walczak. Hey, John, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I want to jump right into it because I gave a pretty lengthy introduction about you and your series Missing in Alaska. I'm curious, as someone else who relishes in telling stories, how did you come across the story about two missing congressmen? And then what was the moment or the thing that, you know, you decided this, I'm hooked. This is something I'm going to dedicate, you know, an extended period of time to. I'm curious. What was that for you?
So you're in British Columbia, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was living in Seattle at the time. It's about 10 years ago, and I was writing for Seattle Weekly, and there was just an afternoon where it was kind of slow. So I went down a Wikipedia rabbit hole of famous disappearances, and you know, most of them I recognized, and then I just saw this disappearance of these two, you know, U.S. congressmen who disappeared in 1972, and I read a lot. I'm a nerd. I like history. I like politics. I was really surprised I hadn't heard of it before. So I just kind of went down a Wikipedia rabbit hole. And, you know, the biggest thing that surprised me is that nobody really recorded a comprehensive history of it. So surprisingly, there was, you know, there's no book. There's no real documentary other than a few one-off episodes of TV shows. So I started making FOIA requests and getting records from the federal government here. And there were a bunch of times that I came close to giving up. I tried to do it as long as I could full time. And eventually it was like find full time worker, end up at a soup kitchen. But I managed to find something just in the nick of time where there was this one person who seemed incredibly inconsequential, but I contacted them anyway as a very brief passing connection to the pilot. And that person connected me to somebody else, and then that person is the person who just broke the story open to me and made me aware of very serious allegations that weren't public and that I hadn't heard before.
Wow. So it sounds like you spent quite a bit of time digging into it before you were like, hey, I've really got something here. I'm curious, did you know from the beginning, like, this would make a great podcast? Like, what was your motivation or thought process behind, you know, turning this into a podcast format?
To be honest, I planned it as a book. So, I just like digging into things. I mean, I love doing archival research. I love research in general. I love reading. So I did it as a personal project and without any ulterior motive. I would have been happy just doing it on my own. But then I wanted to initially do it as a book. So I wrote a book proposal and I pitched it to publishers, literary agents, and I got the same feedback repeatedly, which is, what's the ending? What's the ending? This is a really fascinating story, but do you find the plane? And if you don't find the plane, then, we're not interested. And I think that I thought it was really shallow, pretty crappy feedback, which I know I'm biased, but the stories that are the most fascinating, the ones that really stick with us, are the ones that don't have definitive endings. And I would love for this story to have a definitive ending, as I'm sure you would with what you've worked on as well. But it, just because stories don't have clean, neat, tidy endings, I don't think they shouldn't be told. So I plan to do it as a book. And when that didn't work out, I started looking into doing it either as a documentary or a podcast. Podcast was actually last on my list. And I really don't know why. And now that I kind of stumbled into it, I'm incredibly happy. We have an amazing team of producers, and the ability to tell this story and layer it with music and color that we recorded in Alaska and archival news footage, it just makes it incredibly rich compared to text alone.
Yeah, I asked that question because I thought it translated super well into a podcast. I was hooked from the first episode. That's interesting about the book proposal as well. Before we get too much into some of the behind the scenes stuff, I'm curious, these two congressmen, who were they? Like, who were they of consequence in the political realm? It seems like they were kind of a big deal for their time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so Hale Boggs was a very important congressman. He was the majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives when he disappeared. He was next in line to be the Speaker of the House, so extremely powerful man in D.C. And he played a key role in helping to shape legislation in the 60s, civil rights legislation, for example, with LBJ. And then Nick Begich, he was very important to Alaska, so he was a freshman congressman. He wasn't really big on the national stage yet, though some people speculated to me, because he was so charismatic and earnest and everybody just loved him, that he might have been maybe a future vice presidential candidate, for example. So Boggs was a big deal. I mean, he served on the Warren Commission, which investigated the Kennedy assassination, and he was just at a key place at a key moment in American history. And then Begich was Boggs for Alaska on a state level, on a smaller level, but he was very influential in shaping Alaskan history.
One of the things that stood out the most to me as a fellow podcaster and someone who really digs into their stories as well is, you clearly did a lot of research for this. You talk about that a little bit in the podcast, but I get the sense that there's also probably a lot more that went on behind the scenes that you didn't share. I'm wondering, can you tell me about what it was like to unearth these documents? I mean, obviously you're dealing with a very sensitive political subject as well. And I don't want to give too much away about the story, but there's probably a lot of people who didn't want you finding certain things. What was it like trying to find that primary material? Like, was it pretty plentiful or was it a bit of a struggle?
It was a little bit easier because this was 50 years ago. So I have a running list of stories that interest me, and some are more recent, and those are incredibly hard to get anything worthwhile from the government. It's always a battle to get anything from the FBI, for example. But because this was long ago, it was long enough that it was a little bit less sensitive for the government to release documents, but still recent enough that there were people alive who were primary sources. So the first thing I did was get as many records as I could from the government. So I filed FOIA requests with the FBI, the Army, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, anybody that I could. And I found some interesting things in that. And then really past that, it was going into archives. So I came down, actually moved to New Orleans to dig into archives at Tulane University, which houses Hale-Bopp's papers. And I came for a few months, and I'm still here 8 years later, which is a very New Orleans thing. The archives were an incredible resource. They are an incredible resource to anybody who wants to research, I mean, nearly anything. They're underutilized and underfunded, and I've always found every archivist to be extremely helpful and really happy and grateful that someone's using their resource. It was just really cool to look at all these primary documents. So, for example, Tulane, like I said, houses the Boggs papers. So I got to handle original Warren Commission papers. I got to handle letters from presidents and from celebrities to Hale Boggs. Hale Boggs, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, was on a boat in the Gulf of Mexico, and a helicopter flew over him and dropped a note and a bottle. And it said, basically, the president needs you to get back to D.C. So I found that original note in the files when I was doing research. I found letters from psychics that wrote after the plane disappeared. So it was an incredible amount of color that added to the story. And, you know, and then I also found things that I think maybe probably people accidentally put into the archives. So, for example, I found some life insurance documents. That I have no idea in Alaska that I don't know how they ended up there, but I can't imagine that was on purpose. It might have been an accident. So it's kind of a treasure hunt.
Yeah. And it really shows in the research and the narrative that you tell, like how much research you did. And as someone who is also a nerd when it comes to wanting to go into the archives and research and touch the history, it was much appreciated. So that question was really for me. I don't know how much our listeners will really get from that. But I love what you said about the archives and how important they are to stories like this. One of the things, and you know what, the thing that I guess irked me the most about your podcast, and not necessarily it was because anything that you did, but it wasn't because there isn't necessarily a neat and tidy ending, is that some of the people you just couldn't talk to because they're not here anymore. And one of those people, to me, one of the most fascinating people in your story is Jerry Paisley. And without spoiling too much, I know that's kind of tricky given, you know, where he sits in the story. But can you tell me who Jerry was and how significant he was to kind of the catalyst for the plot of your story?
Sure. Yeah, Jerry is a very fascinating guy. He's someone who is a self-styled philosopher, but he was a member of the criminal underworld, so he had ties to two prominent mafia families. And without giving away too much, he also had ties to someone very close to the disappearance. So Jerry's story is integral to Missing in Alaska, just looking at him as a person, at the claims that he made, at his relationship with certain key characters in the story, and trying to evaluate whether or not he was telling the truth. It's one of the key questions of the show. So the two key questions of the show, number one, where's the plane? And number two, was Jerry telling the truth? So, I don't know how to get too much into it without spoiling the show, but if you want to ask me anything else specific, I'm happy to.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna, like I said, I'm doing this for my listeners, but I'm also doing this a little bit for me. So I am gonna ask a follow-up. You know, again, and you can be as specific as you want, because I think even if people know, you know, and after this they research who Jerry Paisley is, they should still go listen to the series, because it doesn't reveal everything. What do you think, as an investigative journalist, like, what did your gut say when you were talking to all these people, you know, seeing all these accounts of things that Jerry claimed? Like, you know, where was your, I guess for lack of a better phrase, like, where was your bullshit meter at with Jerry? Was it pretty high, or do you think he was mostly telling the truth about a lot of the claims he made?
Hello, nerds. Come listen to the History Nerds United podcast, and let's make history fun again. We interview today's best authors, whether they are established Pulitzer Prize winners or someone debuting their first book. Let us show you that history is not a boring class you took in high school, but a place where the best stories come from. And we don't just cover history. We also love to chat about true crime, biographies, memoirs, and so much more. So head on over to History Nerds United, and let us introduce you to your new favorite book and learn the story behind the story.
History Nerds United.
It's interesting. I try to avoid giving too much of my impression in the show because I want people to make up their own decision. But that said, my gut is that he was telling the truth to a degree. So I think by and large, he told the truth. I think he probably changed some of the details, and that's an opinion that's shared by some of the members of law enforcement that spoke with him. The fact that he had such a key connection to someone involved or tied to the disappearance, that in and of itself is just, it's either an absolutely incredible coincidence or there's something to what Jerry said, the claims that he made. I think that there are, obviously there are coincidences and even grand coincidences in the world, but I also think that, you know, a big thing with this story is that there was a really easy explanation, and that was that the plane disappeared in bad weather, which is, as I say in the show, it's Alaska, it's a small plane, bad weather, it's the obvious answer. And one of the things that I really try hard to say is that's possible. If I could prove one way or another that one of these scenarios was the truth, then I would. But I just try to be as honest as possible with people. But in terms of Jerry, I mean, I think that there are too many coincidences. I think that there's some truth to what he said, at the very least.
Yeah, and I won't say too much more than that. I tend to agree with you as well. It seems like he didn't have a lot of things to gain from not telling the truth. But let's move on, because I wanted to, it's a good transition to go from Jerry to talking about just trying to track down what I would call, and this is my term, quote unquote shady characters, because there are some seemingly shady people in this story. What really stands out to me after listening to the podcast is your time in Arizona. It seems like you had some pretty odd things happen to you and some pretty strange interactions. I'm wondering as a whole, whether it was in Arizona, Alaska, or, you know, just doing, you know, maybe some correspondence over the phone, but what's it like trying to track down people who seemingly have
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Seedy pass and maybe aren't the most affable when it comes to talking to journalists. Like, is that something that made you nervous, but it was obviously something that you maybe had to do? I'm just curious, like, what was your mindset like trying to track down some of these people who probably didn't want you to talk to them?
Well, I really wanted to find these people, and I felt a little bit safer because they're old. So, people joke with me about the mob and the mafia, and that's part of the story. But I traveled extensively in late 2019, right before COVID, with one of our producers, Paul. And I always joked that I was going to sacrifice him to the bears or to the mobsters. Because Paul's like 6'2 or 6'3. So, which we have an amazing team, and I'm very grateful to them. But in terms of talking to shady people, I was worried. Yeah, I was worried about our physical safety at points. You know, a great example of that is there's the son of one of the key players that I was trying to find. I found him, and his name is Steve Fowler. His father, Gene Fowler, is a key player. He's still alive, actually, in this story. And I found Steve at the last minute. It was like 12, you know, midnight, 1 in the morning, something like that. And we had a limited number of days in Phoenix and in Tucson. And I found Steve, and he agreed to meet with us. We showed up at his house, and Paul and I were getting out of the car, just see this door open. Nobody's standing in the door. It's just empty. It's kind of creepy. So was I afraid that I would be killed? Not really. And I, you know, though I joked it would be a nice ending for the show, for at least for everybody else involved. great dramatic ending for the podcast. If you know, there's your ending. But it's interesting. Some people that you think will be friendly aren't, and some people that you're kind of worried about end up being super friendly. So Steve is an example. His father was accused of partaking in a crime, and I figured he'd be really upset that we contacted him. Was a little leery of meeting with him, especially when the door swung open and nobody was standing in the doorway. But he ended up being incredibly friendly. I just talked to him a few days ago. It's become something of a friend, actually. We were careful. Paul was basically the getaway driver. So we traveled with other members of the team too, but Paul was there for everything. So, knocking on the doors of some of these old mobsters, some of them, I knew they were home. I heard people speaking. I heard, the dogs go crazy and the TV shut off when I showed up at the door. And I wasn't concerned that somebody would kill me, but I was more concerned that somebody would be unstable and attack us, because that's just something that happens. You talk to people involved with crimes, whether they're the perpetrators, you're trying to find out more about people that were victims. Even people, families get upset, sons get upset, the people themselves get upset. So I just interviewed somebody else the other day who was a crime reporter in New York, and I was talking to him. And asking him, and he was just, he's been attacked multiple times during his career. So I think physical safety is definitely a concern, especially in the current political environment where the press is seen as an enemy. It almost doesn't matter who you are. I can't tell you how many times people joke to me about fake news, and you're one unstable person away from being attacked. So, I was less worried about being killed by the mafia and more worried about some kind of physical attack. So we were careful in how we approached people. Very aware in approaching homes and knocking on doors, for example. And typically we had a kind of a getaway plan.
Yeah, it seems like you went about it very intelligently, and it is at the same time, like you said, it is good suspense and drama for the series too. Like, there were moments where, you don't know what's going to happen. So that's a really interesting answer. I guess besides, and I also wanted to say it's nice, and I should have asked this, but it's nice that a lot of people did come forward and talk to you, because it sounded like there were some people who maybe you thought, or even as a listener, we would think would be reluctant, but were actually pretty open and honest. And that really, really helped. So you do have two sides to that coin. I'm wondering, beyond difficult people, and this is more of me being a podcaster asking, did you come across any other barriers trying to put a story like this into a podcast format? Like you said, you started wanting to do this as a book, but that didn't really work out. I'm wondering, did you hit any walls that you kind of had to work around in terms of, presenting this as a podcast?
Honestly, not really. And I think that I really attribute that to iHeart. iHeart's been an incredible creative partner. If they weren't, I wouldn't say that, but they've been really, really, really supportive, and we have an amazing team. And it's something that takes an enormous amount of energy out of you. It's extremely rewarding, but it's also tiring. And the fact that we have just a group of people that I really like as people, and also really respect as producers, that's very helpful. So barriers in terms of putting this together. I know when I was pitching it as a podcast, I spoke with three major media companies. I pitched it to three major companies. iHeart obviously said yes. Another major company, I spoke with two executives there, and they gave me basically the same reaction as when I was pitching it as a book, which is, we really want a neat, tidy ending. But this other company, who I will not name, was basically like, why are people going to care? Like, why would people care about these congressmen? Why should people care about this story? Like, will people really care? And then the third company just said no. So it was, I'm not going to lie, it was extremely rewarding when we ended up doing as well as we did, because I think the answer I gave to the second company was marketing, which is, this is just, I've always believed in the story. I'm grateful that people see me and the show as successful, but I think it really boils down to the story itself. If you don't have an interesting story to tell, then it doesn't matter how well you tell it. And you talked about, we just talked about danger. The thing that I tried really hard to do is to be authentic and to tell the story with integrity, especially reporting a story about Alaska. And it's something I mentioned in the show. I talked to a lot of people in Alaska, a lot of Alaskans, who were used to having their state and the people there portrayed in this really two-dimensional way. Everybody's a bush person or a fishmonger who's on the high seas, and so even some of the other shows that have covered this disappearance of Hale Boggs and Nick Begich, they've done a really shady job of it. So, for example, there was one show, and I talked to people who participated in that show, and they went and pretended like they searched a certain glacier, but they were actually on a entirely different glacier, and it's, reality TV is contrived. But I think that there's a happy middle between being really stodgy and stuffy and being completely fake in reality TV. And I think that, to be honest, that's kind of the territory that interests me. Is there are really interesting, fascinating stories that I think, quote, traditional journalists don't really go after because they seem very conspiratorial and sensational, but there's also a really level-headed way to approach them, often that hasn't been done. And to find those stories that kind of meet that middle, that's what I look for, I think.
Yeah, wow. That was really inspiring in a lot of ways. I think I like your determination to stick with a story when you know that there's something there despite the obstacles in front of you. That's great. I'm glad iHeart decided to help take this on with you, and it came to fruition. You said you can't, before this, that you can't really talk too much about what's next, but you do have something else coming down the pipe. Is that right?
Yeah, so I always have a list of stories that I'm looking into, and getting records, that takes forever, so I usually get the ball rolling way, way ahead of time, because it takes months and even years sometimes. So I always have several stories in the cauldron. And I am focusing on one in particular right now, and I'm hoping to drop a new project later this year. I can't get into it too much now. I will tell you about a story that did not work out, though, one that interested me. Maybe you're familiar with it, your listeners. But it was Forrest Fenn's Treasure. And so it's one of the stories that, are you familiar with Forrest Fenn?
No, I'm really curious and intrigued now, though.
Okay, so this is not the thing that I'm working on right now, but it's something that was on my radar. So Forrest Fenn was an antique dealer and collector who, maybe something like 10 years ago, said he hid a chest with about $1 million worth of treasure in it, somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. And he wrote a poem and said that there were, I think, 9 clues in the poem. So in 2015, I went with my partner, and I went to New Mexico just for fun, and went to two places that we thought might be the spot where the treasure was. And it was also just an excuse to go to New Mexico because it's a beautiful place. And, of course, we didn't find the treasure. But I thought after Missing in Alaska, to hunt for a treasure instead of trying to get all these like dangerous, angry people to talk to me seemed like a less stressful thing, especially in the middle of COVID. But then, you know, I emailed with Forrest Fenn, and then I think on a Friday, and then Sunday he announced that someone found the treasure. And then a few months later, he died. So that's an example of a story that really interested me, a more fun story that didn't end up working out because someone found the treasure, and then the main character is no longer with us. So always have a few stories going, and maybe I should focus on stories with fewer people who are octogenarians. So I need to focus on a younger group of folks, maybe.
That's wow. Yeah, that would have been a great story. It seems like timing is a big thing in the storytelling world. I mean, unless you, especially if you want to talk to people, right? It's one thing to tell a story just through documents and archival material, but to interview people, you know, you kind of need them to be alive. I think that helps a little bit, right?
Yeah, it does. And I'll say the archives part and the records part, that's in many ways the easy part. The hard part is getting people to talk to you. And I know you have experience with this, dealing with the Stuka family. When it's something that I was very open about in the show, and it's something that truly bothers me to no end, is how to handle families and friends of people who have died or are missing. I started my career at a newspaper in North Carolina, and I remember having to talk to parents whose kids had died. I remember doing an interview one time with a gentleman who had just proposed to his girlfriend, and then she was hit by lightning and killed. And my editor told me to call him. I dreaded it. I hated that part of the job. It's something that still makes me uncomfortable. I really, on one hand, there are these really fascinating, interesting stories that you want to tell. And on the other, you know, these were people and their family, especially with prominent cases, they get tired of being hounded and being made to relive their grief over and over again. So try to strike a balance of, you know, doggedness and humanity. And at a certain point, if people don't want to talk, as much as I want to talk to certain people, I respect their wishes. Now, that said, if it's somebody like an alleged criminal who's a smart ass and doesn't want to talk to me and tries to play games, I handle that differently. But that's the tricky part, the people. But it's always interesting, like I said earlier, to see who wants to speak, because sometimes people who seem maybe on the outside to be friendly won't talk to you, and other times people who you think are going to be really hesitant to speak to you really want to talk, and you can never predict that. So, you know, I think also my interview style, like we were talking before you started recording, I feel like I come across sometimes as ADD to people. I really prepare for things, and I can, you know, I can converse about them, but I don't like to be super, super structured with interviews because it's just not how I talk naturally, and I think that it takes away from an interview to be too structured. It's good to have the bullet points. It's good to, you know what you want to hit. That's important, and to make sure you don't forget anything. But I tend just to be more conversational. So yeah, I don't remember what the question was.
No, that's okay. That was a great way to wrap it up, because this has been very conversational, and I'm not going to lie, I was a tad bit nervous to talk to you because I did enjoy the podcast so much, and I was hoping that my questions were interesting enough for you to expand on, and I just really appreciate you having coming on the show and talking about the podcast. And if anyone listening hasn't listened to Missing in Alaska, please go check it out. I believe you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I found it on iTunes. So I'm sure, or Apple Podcasts, sorry, not iTunes. It's out there. It's everywhere. Go listen. John, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jonathan Walczak. You can find a link to the podcast Missing in Alaska in the description, as well as my Patreon page. As always, thanks for listening to the Missing and Unexplained podcast with me, Tyler Hooper.
Thank you. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.